Sometimes, a single moment can change a person's entire life. Like when documentary filmmaker Ken Burns saw his father cry for the first time.
It was after my mom died. This one film had given my dad permission to express real emotions.
Or when Sal Khan, a hedge fund analyst, decided to tackle the impossible and educate people around the globe.
When the IRS asked you to mission statement, I filled out free world-class education for anyone, anywhere.
I'm Alicia Burke, host of the new podcast That Made All the Difference, where I talk to achievers about the moments that inspired them to make an impact. This season, along with Ken and Sal, I'll talk to news anchor Dan Harris, Thrive Global founder Arianna Huffington, Mary Davis, CEO of Special Olympics, and athlete and chief inspiration officer Loretta Claiborne.
I thought to myself, who cares about us? But I saw something totally different, that somebody did care.
You can find That Made All the Difference anywhere you get your podcasts. Created by Bank of America. What would you like the power to do?
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. If you're interested in optioning my life rights, you can set up a meeting while I'm in town of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Are you feeling the Gex? Woo! Oh, real heads know that what we were listening to is 745 Sticky, and that is the opening track on 1000 Gex, which is the first full-length album by 100 Gex. This is a record I wrote about a few weeks ago and has been one of the most powerful records of the year for me personally. And so the people asked, and we delivered today a Gex cast. So in a little bit, Larry Fitzmaurice is going to be here, and then Eli Ennis is going to call in, and we're going to talk all things Gex. But part of the inspiration is because I was fortunate enough last night to see 100 Gex perform at NYU. The student program board put on a show, and it was rowdy, man. Like, these kids was wilding. This is in a rec room in the Kimmel Center, and it was a show. It was 100 Gex and Pop Smoke, which is also known as the double Caramonica, I guess. There's got to be some kind of name for a show like that. So 100 Gex played first, and actually were the only people to play because Pop Smoke either some combination of never showed or showed late. And if you look at my Instagram stories, well, I guess you can't look at my Instagram stories, they'll be gone by now. But if you happened to look at my Instagram stories, you will see how buck wild the crowd was going. Allegedly, the tiles on the ceiling underneath the floor started falling off. That's how rowdy the crowd was. This was, from my understanding, only the second 100 Gex show ever. They are going to be on tour with Brockhampton. They're also going to do some solo shows. It was wild. It was extremely intense. I was really happy to be there. It was so nice to see people just clearly having a phenomenal time in like an unquestioned way, like just a very visceral bodily experience. I bought the shirt, these one-off shirts, 100 Gex NYU performance. I'll post a picture of it online. 100 Gex is misspelled on the front. I mean, deliberately, I would presume. And 100 Gex on the back, it looks like basically a t-shirt that like a student group would make. It's like, you know, limited run, tiny, like a LOL, this is what our dorm t-shirt looks like. On the back, it says 100 Gex came to NYU on October 1st, and then there's like a list of various things that they did. Maybe three out of the seven actually happened. Definitely made a huge mess is one of them. Also, it turns out there was a lot of Popcast fam unexpectedly at the Gex show. This is an NYU student-only show. So shouts, first of all, to Federico, who came through and got tickets for me. I brought Joe. Joe and I were deciding whether we should go in the pit or not. We did not ultimately end up going in the pit, so our apologies to the pit. But so first of all, thank you to Federico, who really came through on that. Also, shout out to Marco, who had Federico's job 2 years ago, and I went to see Saw Baby and Juliana Huxtable in that same room, an equally lit show. So salute to Marco. Some podcast listeners, Larisha was there. I met Wynn and Wynn's roommate, Erica, who was not there, but also apparently a podcast listener. So salute to you guys. Also, what's up to Bradley and what's up to Cody? Now, let's get into the Gex, all 100 of them.
My boy's got his own ringtone. It's the only one I know, it's the only one I know. My boy's got his own ringtone. It's the only one I know, it's the only one I know. My boy's got his own ringtone. It's the only one I know, it's the only one I know. My boy's got his own ringtone. It's the only one I know, it's the only one I answer.
So it is a small but dedicated group of people who have written about 100 Gex. Got the gang together. Or at least later is going to be almost a full gang. We're starting. Larry Fitzmaurice is here. Larry, say hi.
How's it going?
Larry, second time on podcast. Larry is the executive editor of The Fader, but reviewed this for Pitchfork in a prior life.
That's correct.
Larry, this review is let's cut to the chase, man. It's a 7.4. This seems like a low number to me, man. What's really good? Who I gotta talk to?
I don't decide the score.
Should we just dispel the notions right now for anybody who doesn't know how Pitchfork scores or any scores really are given?
I'll gladly hand out any editor's email addresses after the show.
Wow, savage. So I think this is probably meant to be a 74.4 would be my guess.
Yeah, 74.4 Gex.
Totally reasonable. That's a good percentage of Gex. So talk to me about, first of all, how did this album come into your life?
That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, so the album came out in May. I reviewed it in July. Right. And it was one of those things where this doesn't really happen that much anymore, which is kind of surprising because we all live on the internet. You'd think it'd happen more often. But about 4 or 5 different people or different outlets were talking about it all around the same time. I had coworkers at The Fader that were talking about it. I had read Singles Jukebox on Money Machine.
Yep.
One of my former colleagues, Colin Joyce, is always in the know.
Mm-hmm.
Also kind of pointed them out to me. Always up on it. And yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I was very intrigued by the visuals for Money Machine and just kind of dove in from there. And
so were you up on the Dylan Brady, like other stuff and the solo stuff and the prior Gex EP at all prior to this?
No, I worked backwards.
Yeah, same.
I feel like a lot of people did for this, which again, it was one of those, I mean, it's kind of nice when you find something.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this person's been doing things for a little bit before that.
It's funny you say, because you talk about how the internet kind of sorts and filters, right? And I think we've become so accustomed to like a very coherent filtration system that I don't even think about it as a filtration system. It just seems like the new normal, in the same way that like 15 years ago records came out a certain way and we just accepted that's how they came out. Now the filtration systems of the internet are just pretty much the normal. But there was something whispery about this. Like, I remember seeing a couple of random tweets on arbitrary accounts, and I was just like, why does this person talk about that and also this person talking about that? Like, that's weird.
Yeah, and the whispers were just loud enough with this. I mean, to the point where I actually found myself thinking earlier today, maybe there was a chance I would have never heard this record.
Exactly right.
Which is kind of sad to think about.
But that's exactly because it was not designed. You know, there's no publicist. There's management. There's no publicist. Mm. This was not something that appeared in anybody's inbox, or at least not in mine. Maybe someone who's more plugged in than I am got it in their inbox. But it was also refreshing because I think for people like us, we want to feel like we figured something out.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's like one of the few remaining paths to joy in our lives is like, hey, maybe I found something.
Yep.
So it was nice to feel, even if for a fleeting moment, hey, maybe I found something. That was cool. All right. So you hit it. You press play. You know, after your hair returned to your head, what were your immediate reference points or emotional kind of gut check responses?
It definitely felt like the musical version of the end of The Fifth Element when Lilu's watching kind of the history of the world in visual form and kind of absorbing it. You know, there's, I think part of what's so much fun about what Dylan and Laura Less do is that you can kind of sit around all day and play connect the dots with the reference points.
Yeah.
They sound, it's very maybe prismatic in that, like, you can look at it from so many different angles and it sounds like so many different things. Mm-hmm. Like,
you know, you can hear what you want to hear. I mean,
yeah. There's reference points for everybody. I mean, every time I read something, someone writes something on them, I'm like, oh, I didn't even think of that. But you know, I think that's kind of a muscle that people who write about music, but also people like who care about music, do enjoy kind of like, you know, working out a little bit, like being like, oh, this reminds me of this, and that. Sometimes that can be annoying, but I think with 100 gecs, there's a lot of fun in kind of being like, oh, wow, like this sounds like 8 different things together. It's like going to like a specialty shop and like finding a sandwich that has all these different elements on it and being like, I don't know if that's going to work. And then you're like, yeah, this works really well.
And also, I think what's intriguing with that framework specifically is, look, there's endless number of records that where you can do that and you say, well, it's Bob Dylan and Town Van Zandt and Emmylou Harris. Like, you could do that, but that's boring and it's been done 1,000 times and those people are all critically revered. So you think like, well, I guess like what's really more boring than, hey, this record sounds like 7 other critically revered artists. Like, that's not terribly exciting. What I like is that this is basically detritus. This is just like detritus plus detritus plus detritus equals brilliance. Now, obviously, we can problematize what was detritus and whether it really was and et cetera. But from a broad perspective, the things that are being referenced here are not, they're not centrist. They're not generally critically revered, but they all kind of have a kind of like default populist undertow. And yet it's been compressed into this like very special thing. So
I almost feel like 100 gecs are kind of the full realization of where like maybe 10 years ago I really wanted music to go. The one act that I always go to that doesn't get referenced enough by contemporary acts, but I feel like their heart is in 100 gecs' music quite a bit, is the Tough Alliance, Swedish indie pop duo who's on this label, Sincerely Yours.
Yep.
The music they made was very blindingly bright, dance pop. It kind of had Pet Shop Boys in it, but was also, you know, a little political, a little insidious, a lot going on there. But there is this boldness and kind of this unashamed omnivorousness to Sincerely Yours and a lot of Swedish indie that was in the late 2000s that just kind of tapered off in the 2010s. Mm-hmm. We kind of, I think things got a little formulaic, let's say. About the way things sounded in indie. And
do you want to, should we play a Tough Alliance song?
Yeah.
Let's, what do you want to play?
We should play A New Chance.
A New Chance.
From their album, A New Chance.
So I feel like with the Tough Alliance, part of what you're talking about is kind of like the ethic of the band and the ethics of that band and the ethic, not right. ethics, but ethic of that band and of 100 gecs. And that sort of like a macro approach to the holistic sound. There are also just like a zillion micro moments, right? Like literally a zillion micro moments on this record. I actually kind of wanted to draw attention. I don't know if it was deliberate, but I want to draw attention to at least one. So let's play the beginning of I Need Help Immediately, and then also the beginning of Teach Me How to Dougie by Cali Swag District.
I need help immediately. Please do something.
Now, I don't know if this was intentional. I don't know if it's a sample or a nod or an homage. But what it did get me thinking about is so often the moments in a song that really stick with us are not necessarily a hot lyric, a specific emotion. It can be like just, it's almost like the gif of song. It's just like this tiny little gestural thing. So when I heard this song, the way the drum kind of like hits and then kind of falls off just immediately took me to that sensation of hearing that in Teach Me How to Dougie. And in many ways, obviously that song is, it's a good rap song, verses are fine, viral dance craze. But in many ways, to me, the kind of most important gestural part of that song is the way the drums kind of slip just off beat, like the And when I heard this, I was like, oh, someone else heard this weird thing on this song that most people were just dancing to. And to experience music that way, I think is very modern. It feels very, I mean, frankly, it feels very TikTok if we're here we are in 2019, but it feels very like of the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because when you mentioned that song, I thought you were going to bring up that part of that song sounds like the McDonald's jingle. Because there is that a moment in it where it's like da-da-da-da-da, but like slightly, like a slight melodic inversion. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time
I thought that was a Night Court theme song.
Is it?
I don't know.
That's the thing. It's like there's so many ways to look at this music. Everybody hears kind of different things in it, which is what I think what's made it so exciting for people.
Right. And again, it allows you to access these kind of recessed parts of your own sonic memory, which is really good. But also the filtering system here is very much, we're not going to take you to a song. We're going to take you to a micro gesture, like a literal, like something that's so quick that maybe you wouldn't have caught it except subconsciously or subcutaneously. And we're just going to basically like use it as one of 100 parts in this other thing. So to me, listening to this album in full is just like steadily being triggered over and over and over and over to the point where, I mean, it's only like what, 20 minutes or 25 minutes long. And I couldn't listen to it all the way through. Because I kept, like, my brain was, there were too many things my brain was doing to actually just acknowledge that, hey, this is a 90-second song. Like, it was mostly just like, wait, it's this, and then it's this. And I had to pause and kind of, like, try to filter out and sort my thoughts and then return to it and then go again. Now I can listen to it all the way through. But when I first did, I just was so constantly triggered over and again.
I mean, it's kind of the sonic equivalent of looking at a screen for a long time to me, where it's like, this is starting to maybe give me a little bit of a headache, but like, there's something about my brain wiring, I'm talking about me specifically, where like looking at a screen like triggers like some sort of dopamine rush, and I'm just going to keep doing this even though maybe it's hurting my head a little. That's kind of how I felt about the first like 5 times I listened to this album. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, now it kind of just goes down like water for me in a good way.
Yeah.
But it is the kind of thing where, you know, it's abrasive. It's abrasive and there's a lot going on. You have to kind of get used to it.
So let's talk about abrasion, because I do think that in order to accept that this record is, you know, valid or good or any of these things, you have to accept that there is something, I mean, not to be mundane, but there's something smooth about what it's in reaction to. You have to accept that. Now, obviously, that's not universally true. And I'm sure like some hardcore kids will like send me an email or whatever. Like, OK, cool. Just point noted. But the way that this album functions feels like stomping on a bunch of, you know, whatever's happening, Spotify core, Playboy Cardi and Migos flows. Like, it just feels like it's just like, ah, no, none of that. Like, ah, disruption. From a kind of sonic political ethic, does it remind you of anything historically, like any moments or any eras in terms of pushback against a prevailing idea?
I mean, I kind of wonder what a lot of the new pop guys and artists of the 80s would have thought of this, kind of like Art of Noise, Heaven 17, like Skritti Politti, artists who made, who came from like both like kind of the failings of first wave punk.
Right, so you're talking like art punk, basically.
Yeah, art punk, but like the, where like the notion was embracing pop as kind of its own punkish rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
I think sonically, they like those guys would probably think this was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
You know, another like recent thing that connects to that movement, I feel, is PC Music, which obviously Dylan Brady is kind of not associated with, but in the same, you know,
a child of
MCU.
I think kind of a child of.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think a lot about Krunk.
Mm.
Not that I believe Krunk is like fundamentally a standalone, like I understand it's an outgrowth of a lot of things, obviously, that were happening in Atlanta and Miami and other parts of the South in the late 80s to the mid 90s and whatnot. But when I think of the kind of like the destructive tendencies and how hard some of those drums hit in comparison to the relative smoothness of what was happening elsewhere in the genre, this maintains some of that same chaotic energy to me. So it's not that Gex are without historical precedent or without framework precedent. It's just that we have become acclimated in the internet era to like a persistent absorption. You know, I think a lot about Post Malone and sort of this kind of like, it's just, it's smooth and it never ends. And like the radio is starting to sound like the internet in that regard. This feels like the first album I've heard that really says, we are taking the same starting points. We're online too, but like we're here to kick the mess out of you.
Yeah.
Like we're not here to just stay online in this kind of mundane way. Like we're here to like, I don't know, like Godzilla the whole thing.
I mean, I think it's the second pop album this year too that has a direct aesthetic connection to Kanye West Yeezus.
Yes.
The first being the Billie Eilish album.
That's low-key smooth.
It's low-key smooth. It's almost like kind of like throwing Yeezus in a washing machine, that album.
Oh, that's generous. But I'll grant it to you, but it's generous. Also, Billie on SNL was not the wave.
Watch it.
It's not the wave. Come on, I want better for her.
I'm still catching up on The Affair. But No, I mean, 100 Gex kind of embraced the, or 1,000 Gex, the album that we're talking about, kind of embraces the, that kind of 18,000 sounds at once chaos.
Yep.
It's interesting you mentioned Post Malone, too, and kind of the smoothness of the streaming era, the algorithm era, because I do feel like 100 Gex almost represents the inverse of streaming culture, in which, you know, for every kid who's just throwing on Discover or indie playlists or whatever, there's also kids who are making playlists where, like, you know, they listen to, like, Stockhausen and Lil Jon.
Yeah.
And Ariana Grande and, you know, John Zorn. Like, it's, you know, I mean,
yo, who's listening to Ariana Grande and John Zorn? Like, who's that kid?
Dylan
Brady. That kid's like my friend. Yeah, that kid's like the person who's going to come from the future. That's my Terminator. Who's going to come from the future to murder me and take over Popcast. So if that's you, email us at popcastnytimes.com. Let's just get the process rolling right now.
And don't kill me.
No, Pedro stays. Pedro stays. I do agree with that. And also, this is, look, not to get too deep into the kind of algorithm conversation, but like to me, what you're just describing was the promise of like the infinite jukebox, right? It's like it could be anything and it could be disruption. But then I think what streaming services realize is their primary investment was like maintaining your ear attention. And the safest way to do that was not to feed you something different every 2 minutes or 3 minutes, but to feed you roughly the same thing or something that was like 2% different to keep you locked in. But like when I listened to this, I was like, oh, this is what I thought the internet jukebox was going to be like super weird, unusual cross like references of like, hey, this thing from 2002 has a lot to do with this thing from 2014, which has a lot to do with this thing from 1986. And that's kind of what I always thought it was going to be. But I guess it just never, no one in charge ever agreed with that.
I mean, if we want to talk about more promises fulfilled here, we can go back to the beginning of the decade. Everybody's forgotten about these guys now, but Salem. The beginning of the decade, they came out with
R.I.P. Salem, man.
If they came out now, I feel like they would be more well received.
First of all, low key, I like Salem.
Yeah, they were good.
Did you go to that weird show in like the Chinatown Art Gallery that one time?
And I saw them at Santos.
Yeah, I saw that show
too. R.I.P. Santos
as well. Shout out to Alec. They did a show in like an art gallery. I guess the part of Chinatown that's like so far east, it's like kind of where like Mission Chinese is now. It's okay. Like, I don't know if that's technically still Chinatown, but they did a show and it was just like full of smoke. And it was, you know, it was just like, it was just, it was perfect. I walked out and I was like, is this good? Is this bad? Like, I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I think I probably wrote that it was good because I think my gut was like, this is probably good. But at the same time, I was just like, I'm vexed.
Right.
Like, everything about this is just extremely vexing. But yes, shouts to Salem.
Yeah, they were ahead of their time with kind of, you know, genre mishmash, mm-hmm. not caring about how it all came out in terms mm-hmm. of presentation.
Slowcore meets DJ Screw, yep. meets yada, yada, yada.
I also always thought, when the first time I heard when Post Malone came out with White Iverson, I was like, I guess this guy listens to Salem because it had the same kind of crawl to it.
Yo, that's a fire take, Larry. That's fire.
You know, I mean, that's smoothed out a bit. And now I feel like we are at the end of the decade and we finally gotten an idea of what Salem's...
The Salem we deserve.
Yeah, I mean, kind of, 100 Gecs kind of are that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, but to that point, so Salem did what 100 Gecs is doing, but Salem did it for like slow and depressing music and 100 Gecs does it for... Sorry, I'm just going to keep doing that. So I want to play two songs that 100 Gecs reminded me of. And now I want you to keep in mind that I am half Italian, half Jewish, and I'm from outer Brooklyn. So you know I listen to a little bit of tacky dance music. You know it speaks to my soul. So let's play Raquel's In a Dream and Cascada's Every Time We Touch. KTU gang, yeah. Step up.
103.5.
Preset number 4 on my car stereo. It's before Z100, but after Lomega.
Nice.
Now that you've tasted a little bit of the erotic songcraft of my teenage to 20-something years, shouts to Raquel, there is something particularly punishing about the dance music of that era, the club music of that era. And I identify like Long Island and Jersey Bridge and Tunnel Club, and I don't mean like Jersey Club, like for everybody, like if Nick Catchdubs is listening, I don't mean Jersey Club. I mean like Jersey clubs. There is something so kind of a nomadic drill, not drill like Pop Smoke or like British or Chicago, like nomadic, like something so nomadic drill about that music. And certainly reminds me of a lot of Latin freestyle from the 80s. It's kind of feels like directly descended from that stuff. But it has this kind of like chirpy sensuality to it. It's like high pitched vocals. And that stuff just really has always been deeply embedded in me. When I was listening to songs here, especially, maybe we should play a little bit of I Would Never Stop You, which is rendered really hilariously with all the XXX and, you know, like GeoCities tags and whatnot. Let's listen to a little bit of that, the real, like, up with the bass parts.
Let's go all the way.
So I was listening to this song, and then there's one later on, Hand Crushed by a Mallet, both of which kind of reminded me of these genres. And this is to circle back maybe to kind of like the detritus thing, where these are not genres. Like, we haven't even talked about dubstep. We haven't talked about crabcore. We haven't talked about, you know, like sort of like bleached hair, 2006 to 2009 Warp Tour, electro dance bands. Like, some kid DM'd me today and was like, when I had these videos on the show last night on my Instagram story, and he was like, is that Blood on the Dance Floor? You know, like a fair question, right? Like, totally plausible question. But these kind of detritus genres were not critically embraced. And now I wonder, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more when Eli calls in, but like, I wonder, is it just that critical embrace doesn't have any meaning anymore? If you're like this young and like raised on the internet, you don't even have a concept of what was or wasn't critically embraced. Is it that critics now, as two of sitting at this table, are just like more open-hearted and more open-eared now to embrace something like this? Or do you think like we're all being perverse and being like, yeah, we didn't really like that other stuff, but we do like this. Although low-key, I like that other stuff.
Well, I think with like the kind of like the big room.
Actually,
like,
high-key, I'm sorry.
I mean, I love that Cascada song. I love that kind of music in general. I always have as a Dance Dance Revolution kid.
Hey!
But that kind of DDR, big room, trance sound was critically reviled for a really long time. And then I think over the last decade or so, people have started to come around to it. I mean, Simon Reynolds and Energy Flash, when he... one of the most recent editions of it. And Simon, if you're listening, correct me if I'm wrong, but
BobcastNYTimes.com, Simon, hit my line.
I think in the preface he mentions, like, you know, in retrospect, I was a little hard on trance. Trance is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And you've had Lorenzo Senni, who's I think Warp signed right now, doing pointless trance,
yep,
kind of like arting it up a bit, which has kind of always been the reaction to, you know, more like populist dance music, to kind of art it up.
Right.
But 100 Gecs are not arting it up. They're very much like, this is it. And maybe actually we kind of added some high fructose corn syrup to the mix too. And like, that's kind of okay with me too.
And you know what's interesting? I don't think this is in my piece, because I feel like I just thought of it, but maybe someone else did it. But like, it also reminds me a lot of Baltimore Club, Footwork, Juke. Like, it's, you know, that kind of like hyper sped up vocals, like drums that really are like,
yep.
Like, it does have a lot in common with that. All right, before Eli calls in, there's just one other reference point that I feel like I got to get on the record, because we're going to forget about it. And that's my guys in Broken Side. Salute some real pioneers, Broken Side. I know you think I'm capping. I am not capping. So Broken Side had a record in 2009 called I'm Not a Fan, But the Kids Like It, which is could perhaps be the theme song for what people who listen to Popcast think. It's not the Popcast theme song, because I am the kids, but it could be the theme song for some of the emails I get. So Broken Side were from, I want to say, Colorado, maybe? And they were sort of on the tail end of that Warped Tour movement. They did, like, very electro-punk hip-hop, very spasmodic music. So I think we should just listen to a Broken Side song as we're transitioning into part two of the podcast. So I welcome everybody, Freaks, 2X's by Broken Side. I walk into the club looking kind of sexy now. Okay, guys, I hate to interrupt Broken Side, a band based on interruption, but just a tiny bit of official business. There's a website, popcastsurvey.com. I think it was purchased. On that website is a survey. It's a listener survey. Go to it. Tell them how much you love Popcast and how urgent it is to you in your lives. It's popcastsurvey.com. It's up for the next week or two. Hit that and embrace it and drop some gems about what you love about Popcast. And also, like, while we're talking business, thinking about a live event in New York, We email me, popcast@nytimes.com. Let me know if that'd be of interest. I'm curious. I want to know who's here. I want to know who'd come out. And also, we're inching towards t-shirts. I just want everybody to know we are inching towards t-shirts. Hopefully have some news on that soon.
When a woman commits murder, she's often given a label. She's the woman who snapped, the Black Widow, the Angel of Death. Do these labels help, or do they mask the truth behind these stories? I'm Tori Telfer, and I'm hosting a new podcast about the crimes that inspire these names. Why Women Kill, Truth, Lies, and Labels, presented by CBS All Access. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back with part two of the podcast this week. Eli Ennis is on the phone. Eli, what's good?
How's it going, guys?
Eli is a freelance writer. Eli wrote a great piece. He interviewed 100 Gex for The Outline. He has also written for Rolling Stone, Billboard, Kerrang, Jessica Kerrang, and also Decibel while we're on high NRG metal magazines. But Eli is one of the few people who've actually talked to Gex. So, and Eli, I know we were chatting earlier, and I know we were talking about Broken Sides. I thought you'd appreciate us coming in with a Broken Sides song. And I want to say, during the break, I Googled, and Broken Sides were not from Colorado, which is actually very surprising. They are from Albuquerque, New Mexico. So, apologies to, I don't know if I should be apologizing to Colorado or New Mexico. I don't actually know. So, whoever feels like they deserve an apology, I'm sorry. So, Eli, we've been talking a lot about the reference points and the various touchstones. Why don't you talk a little bit about your conversation with them, and then we'll kind of jump into some of the big kind of like internet art questions that the band brings up.
Coming out of the Broken Side song, like that was the first, one of the first reference points I had when I first heard this record. And so I knew going into the interview that I was like, okay, these people have some interesting influences that are definitely outside of the typical canon of highbrow music criticism.
Can I just throw in that I just proposed this to Larry and he won't do it? Someone has to do a 10-year anniversary oral history of I'm Not a Fan, but the kids it. So I'm just it's a free idea. It's a free idea. I'm putting it out there. Anybody can do it. Okay. But please continue.
If you change your mind, Larry, yeah. I'll do it.
I'll let you know.
Okay, but back. I'm sorry. Go back.
No, but I mean, so I went in kind of, you know, seeing, I thought they would have some fascinating things to say about that. But it was really, they were more casual about it. It seems like they didn't really think that consciously about their influences. I was asking them specifically, like, oh, was there anything you really wanted to do? Like, obviously, one of the main the things you think about when you hear the record is like, oh, it sounds like they're mashing genres together. But to them, the way they explained it, like they don't really think of it that way. They were just like, oh, well, we weren't very purposeful. It was kind of just going with whatever worked in the moment. So like the entire, you know, it's easy to say as a critic to be like, okay, here's what you break down the track and say, this is what happens here, here, and here. But to them, it was just very natural.
Right. And, you know, critics sort of end up sometimes being the sorting algorithms. You know, we're the sorters, you know, it's
exactly.
And now one thing that comes up in your piece is they were not in the same location for a lot of the making, or maybe all of the making of this record, correct?
It was about 80%. They said they were emailing back and forth to create it. Yeah.
Now, it struck me as like a very high level of trust with music that is non-obvious music, right? It's not like, oh, I know the melody that should go on this beat, yada, yada, like very straightforward. It just sounds like every other Ed Sheeran song, blah, 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 blah. You know, like this is non-obvious production met with non-obvious vocal approaches. So did they give you a sense at all of, you know, did these things go through drafts? Did they kind of like iterate them? Or is it like just raw energy, early take stuff?
I think there was a lot of tinkering and a lot of going back and forth is what they said. But I think a lot of the melodies just, you know, they like Laura said, for instance, that the Stupid Horse melody just came to her and was pestering her at work in her head for a few weeks. And then she's like, let's just do it. So I think it was kind of they both had these ideas and then switched them and sent them to each other and kind of tinkered with each other's ideas. But it wasn't super calculated in any way. And every time I asked about that, they were just like, eh, no, not really. They're very casual about it.
All right, so we haven't, in the conversation, Larry, you and I did not talk to this point about Money Machine, which is kind of like the big glaring, like, oh, this is the moment of arrival. So let's listen to Money Machine, and I want you to think about how big of a truck do you drive?
You talk a lot of big game for someone in such a small truck. Oh, look at those arms. Your arms look so freaking cute. They look like little cigarettes. I bet I could smoke you. I could roast you. And then you'd love it. You'd text me, I love you. And then I'd fucking ghost you.
Tell me what to do, I'm trying to go to bed. Hiding up the days, I'm trying to get it right. Said it all before, I'm setting up to get on bad alone. Tell me what to do, I'm trying to go to bed. Hiding up the days, I'm trying to get it right. Said it all before, I'm setting up to get on bad alone.
Okay, so Money Machine comes out with a video. That's, to me, is like the awakening moment online, most likely, except for kids who are just like deep in like some Minecraft message boards or whatever. I don't know where kids hang out on the internet. You know, someone should tell me. But, you know, this is the kind of awakening moment. What did they tell you about this song and what did you feel? Was this your first being alerted to them, or were you up on it prior?
I was recommended by a friend who had found it, and I listened through the album straight through the first time. Actually, I don't even think I got through the whole album the first time. I was like, I don't know about this. But Money Machine was definitely the one. Yeah, it was ridiculous. But Money Machine, when I asked about the track order, Dylan said that he wanted to put that second, and it kind of, like, I was thinking it was maybe an intentional move to sandwich that in between 745 Sticky, which has the big dubstep drop, and 800 dB Cloud, which has like a metal breakdown. And I was like, well, that's a really poppy one. And he was like, yeah, I kind of just wanted to have the hooky one up there at the top because he considered the easiest song on the album, quote. So I think it's a great intro point because it is the most conventional pop song, I guess you could say. I mean, it's the most, probably one of the most melodic ones on the record. But
yeah, again, I mean, to me, like, just Ringtone and this one are, yeah, like Ringtone, the kind of like the centrist songs, in so much as they are centrist. When you were talking to them, you know, you mentioned sort of like how casual their kind of like self-conception was. Mm-hmm. What else came up for you? Did they bring up any touchstones that, you know, hadn't crossed your mind already? Like, where did they feel that they were drawing from?
I think what was interesting was that they just kind of seemed to be drawing from whatever they had in their head at the time. Like, something that was an interesting thing they mentioned was, I was asking about all these ridiculous reference points and asking specifics, like, oh, were you influenced by Vaporwave and kind of the character of it? They were like, eh, not really. I was like, were you influenced by Skrillex? They're like, yeah, I guess. Were you influenced by... But what they said was they'd recently come to the conclusion, both of them kind of were growing out of that late teens, early 20s moment when you kind of like try to bury what you were into in high school and kind of write it off as being uncool, and then maybe in your mid-20s come back around to it and be like, all right, this is maybe kind of ridiculous, but I'm gonna appreciate it and say that it's not something I need to be embarrassed about. And they seem to be having that moment at the same time that they were making this record, so I think that maybe translated to, like, for instance, Laura was very into 303 when, yes, she was in high school.
The Kings.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, I'm sorry. We got to play a 303 song.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, because I remember when I was relatively new to the paper, I remember listening to, it must have been the first 303 record, and just thinking like, man, this is genius. And then I'm looking around and I'm like, nobody thinks this is good. This is like possibly a top 10 record. Like, it was so good. And it does feel very exciting that there are other people who heard those records and were like, yeah.
Very Long Island.
Oh, so good. Like Long Island Losers. Like, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mess with it. All right, so we got to play something by the Kings, 303. who I just Googled, and it is 303 that is from Colorado. Duh. So apologies again to the Brookenside Massive. So let's play something off of a record. This is a record that came out in 2010. The record was called Streets of Gold. Let's play House Party.
Gonna have a house party in my house. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
party!
Thursday, Friday, Saturday,
party!
Sunday, better find somebody else. So for one day, I don't have to clean up after myself. I'm gonna have a house party in my house. I'm gonna pour booze down my mouth. I might stay up until the AM.
This is a band that was sort of very Warped Tour popular in the late 2000s and the early 2010s. And how did Laura describe her interest in this band, Eli?
She was like, oh, it was super sick in high school. Like, I was like, Brokenside are the sickest. And then, or I'm sorry, not Brokenside, 303.
Same difference. It's cool. It's all gang.
It's like she said, quote, I used to be such a big 303 fan. And then I think for 2 years, maybe I was like, man, 303 is not cool. That's just whatever. And now she went and saw them again. And it's just like, this is the shit. Why the fuck would I ever say 303 was not the sickest? And I was like, that's so funny.
Exactly right. I fully Popcast approves that message like 100%. And now I remember, so I used to cover Warped Tour. I used to cover mostly live shows when I started the paper, and I used to cover Warped Tour, and this was the era that I was covering Warped Tour. We're talking 08 to maybe 2012. Say it louder so the cheap seats can hear. And I remember at that time, all the Warped Tour purists were like, this isn't punk. You know, like you would go and like you'd see like Attack, and people would be like, that's not punk. And I was like, it's actually somehow more punk than punk. It's like flamboyant and gender bending and electro, and they're playing to like Pennywise fans. Yeah. Like that's pretty punk. Extremely punk to me as an ethos. But there were a lot of bands during that era doing this or like basically some desiccated version of this. And I remember at the time thinking like, this could possibly break through. Like this, someone could kind of like pachinko their way out of this into like some real pop hits. I don't know if it ever really happened, but no. I always felt like that scene could potentially, I guess 303 maybe was that.
It's not a one-to-one, but I mean, you know, look at what Brendan Urie did over the last decade.
Sure.
He did kind of parlay that into real deal.
Middling singer, Brendan Urie.
Very Broadway pop. But I think Gex would have 100% been on Warped Tour, and it's
fun. I think they were there. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I think Gex were the kids. Because, like, when you would see those bands at Warped, they were not playing main stages for the most part, except maybe, like, someone like 303, like, later in the later years. But, like, in the early years, they're playing side stages. And you would see there was always this kind of tension in the audience. There'd be, like, basically, like, a few misfits. I say that with affection, who are like, that's what they're there for. They're there to watch this. And then you have like punk fans who are sort of like with their arms crossed, like, what is this? Like, it's sort of like a thing I like, but like, not really. Like, where's the melodic hardcore stage? You know, like that's, they're like, you know what I mean? Like, they're like, where's the Devil Wears Prada? Like, that's where I want to go. And I do feel like when I listen to Gex, I'm like, oh, maybe you guys were the ones who went to Warped Tour for this in like 2010. And if so, salute. And I was happy to see you there. You know, like.
Yeah, it's funny. I asked specifically about the metal breakdown on 800 dB Cloud because, it's like
screamo into grindcore, basically.
Exactly. I thought it was Attack, but it's funny because Laura said, oh, no, I was actually just trying to channel Cannibal Corpse there.
Wow.
Like, she was going for like this old school death metal thing. I was like, oh, it came across as very Attack to me.
Oh, which that's is my, it's funny because I was thinking of Attack on Stupid Horse. I was thinking of Attack.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Should we play an Attack song?
Oh, man, please,
we're really recovering. I feel like we're recovering a lot of cultural memory here.
Stick Stickley. You got to do Stick Stickley.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. So by request, here is Attack Attack. Strike your crab pose. Stick Stickley.
What?
I wanted to talk about one other real reference point that jumped out at me, especially on 745 Sticky. I was thinking a lot about kind of like IDM and glitch and, you know, kind of IDM standing for heavy sigh, intelligent dance music, which is just like a terrible, terrible name. And like, I just would prefer it didn't exist. But like, when you think of kind of like early 2000s, like haute art techno into... you know, sort of stuff that like weirdly maybe ends up a decade later, a subset of what we think of as EDM, because it's like very loud and very like clangorous. But at the time was basically just like, you know, bedroom nerds like speeding up techno to like 180 BPM or whatever. So I was thinking a lot about Kid 606, and Kid 606 in that scene was very prolific and put out loads of records and put on a lot of people. You know, I was thinking about Venetian Snares, but Kid 606, because of the kind of chaos of those Kid 606 records, a lot of what was happening on Gex reminded me of that. So I feel like while we're literally just throwing everything in the kitchen sink, let's play something off of Down With The Scene, which is the first, I think it's the first full-length Kid 606 project. Shout out all Tiger Beat 6 Massive. Let's play, I mean, honestly, if to my memory, all these songs sound the same, so I'm just going to pick the one with the best name. Let's play Luke Vibert Can Kiss My Indie Punk White Boy Ass. While we're all just spilling bona fides, I remember seeing Kid 606 play Tonic, R.I.P.
Oh, wow. Rest in peace.
R.I.P. Tonic, a formerly great space. So, Eli, one thing that kind of came up in your piece, and I wanted to kind of expound upon it with you guys, is the specificity of the kind of like late internet era-ness of this music. And Larry and I were talking a little bit in the first part about, like, basically, I always thought the infinite jukebox, quote unquote, whatever, you know, whatever that is, would guarantee that we'd all listen to a bunch of weird shit all over the place, right? Like, we would just a bunch of weird stuff constantly. We'd be changing moods and changing sounds and da-da-da. And it turned out that that's not what happened. Algorithms got the best of everybody and everything is just super smooth in Spotify core and yada, yada, yada. In this music, I hear the promise of what I thought internet art and internet sound would be like. Late period internet stuff. And I wonder if you can talk to me a little bit more about, partially from your conversation with them, but also just how you read this kind of like incursion, this sonic incursion at this moment in 2019.
The idea that the album sounds like scrolling through Twitter or Instagram or TikTok was something that registered with me quite quickly. I think a lot of people. And I asked them about that and they were kind of like, I asked them if that was like a grand statement they were trying to make about about our current culture. And it wasn't really. It was just a reflection of their own experiences. Just as they are people who they were like, oh, we're just constantly online. We live online. And our music, I guess, is a reflection of that. And I think that really speaks to the current era. I mean, these are people who are making music that's so inextricable from the internet, so much that they're not even conscious of it. It just is. And I think the music, not just lyrically, that every single song is about them texting, relationships being carried out over text or messages and like everything.
Yeah, we haven't even really talked about the lyrics that much, but like they are basically just about digital, like the successes and failures of digital communication.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's really interesting to me is, I mean, look, there's been so much bad music in the last 5 years that has been made about the terrors of digital life, mm-hmm. you know, St. Vincent's Digital Witness, the Damon Albarn album about monsters, the St. Vincent produced song on the Sleater-Kinney album. You know, these are all examples of just dull.
Larry, continue to name records I don't care about. Please, literally continue to name songs I don't care about.
I mean, there's just been so much, you know, miserabilia that's kind of reflected the prevailing attitude you see on social media. Oh, like, I can't get off this site. The site's driving me crazy. Mm-hmm.
But fun, too.
Yeah, and it's fun. And
it's fun.
I think we forget a lot of the time that there's, you know, like, as much as, like, social media can be a bugbear or the internet can be a hellscape, it's a place for communities to come together, too. And I feel like 100 Gex is, like, kind of the perfect representation of, like, these, like, you know, sometimes it's okay to just have some fun with your friends on the internet.
And also the act of like scrolling through these platforms, the act of absorption is engaging. It's fun to me in the same way that music discovery was fun to me in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, the 80s were a decade. That was 3 to 4 decades ago for those podcast listeners who were not alive then. But the idea that around any corner, something fascinating and world exploding can happen is a sentiment I still feel about the internet. Even though most of it has been sucked dry, but like social media especially like opens up those opportunities again and again. And when I listen to Gex, that's sort of the energy I'm getting is like, oh, you weren't ready for this. And then another thing you weren't ready for. So to me, capturing that joy is like an essential part of this proposition.
Also the subset of gamers.
Yeah. Can we talk about Minecraft? Eli, have you watched or participated in any of this Minecraft stuff that they do?
No, I have not.
Okay. Cause we haven't either, but like, can someone talk me through it a little bit? Cause I'm not sure I totally understand what it was.
As they spoke it to me, it was essentially, there's like everyone, like fans will congregate in a specific Minecraft server that'll be named days before or whatever. And then within that server, there'll be DJs performing, you know, from their computers, but it'll be streaming their music live mm-hmm. into the server. So you're okay. Essentially a digital music festival.
So basically everybody like arrives at an appointed time in an appointed place, and there is someone there playing music only in that place.
Yes.
And it just happens to be a Minecraft server or territory or whatnot. Man, I'm really showing my age. I don't know anything about Minecraft.
It's like when Marshmallow DJed in Fortnite.
All of those words, I'm sure, are true. Every word you just said, I'm certain, are completely factual. Okay, so before we go, is there anything else that we should touch on about 100 Gex besides our collective ecstasy at being in the moment? Eli, anything else from the interview that really sticks with you?
That they got the remix project coming up. I don't know if you guys touched on that.
No, not at all. Speak on it.
So this has been like semi-announced on their Twitter, but essentially they released the stems for 1000 Gex a while back so that anyone can download the files and tinker with their songs and remix them on their own.
Popcast mix.
As far as I know, eventually they're going to sort of assemble that into a remix album and release that sometime soon. Date to be decided.
Pedro's going to make a podcast mix.
They're going to have to pay me.
They're okay. Yeah, Pedro says send the contracts. Larry, anything else before we go?
Yeah, I mean, we've spent a lot of time today talking about, you know, music that previously was unloved or critically derided that 100 Gex are kind of, you know, pushing through their lens and making their own. But, you know, this is something, you know, 100 Gex, they, you know, they're on the kind of the outskirts of pop. But this is something that's happening in popular music widespread right now. I mean, you know, Soccer Mommy and Snail Mail both cite Avril Lavigne as influences. Halsey has, you know, a half-body Marilyn Manson tattoo. Dominic Fike's favorite acts are the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Sublime.
Sure.
Latter of which Lana Del Rey just covered on an album that could, like, be nominated for Album of the Year Grammy at the end of the year. Like, you know, these, you are seeing on a broader level cultural porousness.
And also generational disinterest in that kind of tastemaker yay nayness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think younger kids, you know, look, as I'm 32, and when I was 15, 16, it was, you know, someone hands you a Pavement record and you figure it out from there. And I think it's a lot different now.
That sounds like a bad drug transaction. That sounds like, I want a Channel 7 after school special from 1993 with like somebody being like, hey kid, you like to get slanted? You like to get enchanted? I got something for you that'll blow the hair right off your head and realign it on your back. Then there's like someone who just shows up, a real authority figure, is like, kids, a warning about listening to Pavement. You could then spend the next 15 years of your life wearing t-shirts with holes in them and talking only to other men.
I didn't know you could see the holes in this t-shirt from across the table.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. So sorry. That wasn't art aimed at anyone in particular. But yes, I take your point.
No, it's just interesting to me. I mean, you know, like whenever I talk to younger artists, which I kind of categorize as people who couldn't watch TV when 9/11 happened.
Yeah, fair point.
You know, then they're like, yeah, my influences are, you know, Marilyn Manson, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jack Johnson. And I'm like, yeah, this is all stuff that, like, when I was growing up, people, it was like cool to hate. And now it's not really cool to hate anything.
No, I mean, and that's like sort of a broader critical
concern.
Sure,
of course, yeah. But and, I think with regards to young people and influence, I think they're just willing to take from whatever they have and not really care too much about cultivating a sense of cool behind what they're drawing from.
And also, like, the barriers between people and what they listen to are so much lower now, whereas before, the person who was the critic or the tastemaker or the creepy old guy handing you a Pavement record, that's your entry point. But now the entry point is just on your phone. Like, you don't wait for a person to tell you, you just find it.
Yeah, there's no barriers anymore.
Right. So because of that, I think the seamlessness between, like, derided and not derided, popular and not popular, those things don't matter quite in the same anymore. All right. With that said, let's go out. Last song on the 1,000 Gex, drum and bass balladry. This is Gek to You.
I look outside and see
that is our show. Hopefully you'll have some time to reacclimate to real life after we've shattered your eardrums for the last hour. Thank you to Larry Fitzmaurice and Eli Ennis for coming on and talking about the Gex. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, for any Gex reference points we may have missed, or maybe some other sonic detritus from the mid-2000s that you think is unfairly maligned, but that maybe we will love. And of course, subscribe to Podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Google Play, Stitcher, places where Podcast is free, etc. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Pet Stepper Media. We will be back next week.
Yeah, everything is piling up, but that's cool, cause at least I got you, I got you, I got you. Tell me that you don't wanna bug me. I tell you, baby, being here is nothing. Call me anytime you're feeling lonely.